Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 14th of September, these are our main stories. The warming greenhouse gas being called the dirty secret of the electrical industry. Commuter hell in France as protests over pension reforms kick off in Paris. And the desperate housewives star sentenced to prison time over the college admissions scandal. Also in this podcast... the furious debate over whether Rastafarianism can be labelled a religion. And we start in Washington. Noise from outside the White House, where the teenage campaigner Greta Thunberg led a protest about inaction over climate change.
It's very overwhelming, and to just... never give up. We will continue, and see you next week on September 20th.
But as campaigners do more to highlight the dangers of global warming, levels of what's being called the most powerful greenhouse gas, sulfur hexafluoride, are rising rapidly, according to figures obtained by the BBC. The gas is being called the dirty secret of the electrical industry. But what is it? Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, told me more.
Most people have never heard of it. In fact, until a couple of months ago, I'd never heard of it either. It's widely used in the electrical industry. It's incredibly efficient at what it does. It doesn't burn, and essentially it helps prevent short circuits and fires in electrical equipment. So in substations and transformers all over the world, engineers mostly use this gas because they know they can rely on it. The problem with it, of course, is that it's incredibly warming. It's 23,500 times more warming than carbon dioxide. And so even a little of it getting into the atmosphere, for example, 1 kilogram of it leaking is the same as 24 people flying across the Atlantic and back in terms of carbon dioxide.
It's amazing that something so dangerous most people won't have heard of. Do we know why the levels are rising so rapidly?
Well, there's a number of things that have been going on that have made it rise rapidly. And principal amongst them is the switch to renewable energy. In the past, we had large coal-fired power stations, which generally had a few connections to the grid. These have often been replaced now by more and more green energy, by wind farms and solar farms. All of them bring their own connections, and when they're making those connections, engineers tend to use sulfur hexafluoride. And the problem with that is, of course, we're adding more and more of SS6 into the system, and the system often has leaks in it, and the leaks are occurring over and over again all over the world. Now, lots of people have tried to do something about this. The EU tried to ban the gas back in 2014, but lobbying from the electronics industry seems to have paid off. Now, Bas Eickhout is a green Dutch MEP, and he's the man who led the campaign to try to ban it.
The electric sector was very strong in arguing that if you want an energy transition and you have to shift more to electricity, you will need more electric devices, and then you also will need more SF6. So don't tackle this right now. They used the argument that otherwise the energy transition could be slowed down.
So what can be done about it if we can't get this outright ban?
Well, there's at the time when the ban wasn't put in place, when they managed to get away from the ban, the industry said there were no alternatives available. You have to let us use this gas. But since then, over the last number of years, more and more alternatives have come on stream. And that's mainly for medium voltage material. There's also some alternatives coming on for high voltage material. Some of these have, are really starting to come to the fore. We went to a factory in the Netherlands to see a Dutch firm who have been making this type of SF6 free material for the last 40 years. And Elise Morskrift from Eaton Electronics told us a bit about it.
They are already for over 40 years in the field, and they are reliable, they are safe, and they are really working with no use of SF6.
And the thing is that the EU is going to look at this again next year in 2020, but the MEPs that we've spoken to say a ban is unlikely before 2025.
That was Matt McGrath with the findings of that exclusive investigation. Now to a crisis in Nigeria, a country with the highest number of registered missing people due to conflict. In the chaos of attacks during the decade-long insurgency of the Islamist group Boko Haram, many people, mostly young, have become lost. There are 22,000 registered missing, but the true number is likely to be much higher, according to the International Red Cross. Our Nigeria correspondent, Myeni Jones, headed to Borno State, the epicentre of the crisis, to find out more.
In the shade of a crumbling, abandoned football stadium, a group of about 100 people listen to volunteers reading out a list of names on megaphones. The dusty field around us is home to internally displaced people in the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri.
This camp is only a year old, but already 12,000 people live here. Some of them are waiting anxiously to hear the name of their relative being called out. They're hoping today is the day that they will be reunited with them.
Nearby, in one of the camp's basic shelters, a young couple looks sadly at the picture of a boy on their phone. Kabiru and Ashibi lost their son Shuibu 5 years ago when their village Baga was attacked by Boko Haram. He was just 9 years old. As she fled, Ashibi was faced with an impossible choice.
I have a baby that was breastfeeding. That's why I had to leave him. The boy I was breastfeeding was crying constantly and Shubu couldn't walk, so I had to make a choice. If I wasn't breastfeeding, even if it was too big, I would have carried him and taken him with us. I knew if I stopped, Boko Haram would kidnap me. That's why I left him. And I regret it.
More than half of those missing in conflict in Nigeria were under 18 when they were last seen. Some, like Usuma and Salisu, have been successfully reunited with their families. They're 17 and 9 years old and were found in neighbouring Chad before being returned to their families in May. Salisu, the youngest of the two, remembers the moment when he saw his father outside the window of the plane bringing them back to Nigeria.
When they finally let us step out, I ran and hugged my father and he picked me up.
But these reunions are rare. Only 367 missing people have been found in Nigeria to date. In the chaos that follows attacks, people lose track of each other, often ending up in camps for the internally displaced. The remoteness of many parts of the northeast is another challenge. Monguno in northern Borno is only accessible by helicopter. The GGSS camp in Monguno, northern Borno, is a sprawling camp for internally displaced people. It's one of the largest camps in Monguno, which is as close as we can get to territory controlled by Boko Haram and the Islamic State West Africa province. As such, it's at the front line of efforts by humanitarian agencies to help people affected by the conflict. For Peter Maurer, president of the Red Cross, access is crucial to reuniting families.
In Nigeria, there is broad territory and groups which are out of reach of ICRC. And so populations under control of these groups are not reachable by the ICRC, and that's the reason why it is more difficult to reunify family as in other places.
These families are bearing the brunt of Nigeria's decade-long conflict with Boko Haram. Many haven't seen loved ones for years, but in camps across Borno State, they continue to wait and hope that those who were missing will one day be found.
That was Myeni Jones. For anyone trying to get to work in Paris, there were scenes of chaos on Friday as key transport systems ground to a halt. Public transport workers walked off the job in the first major protest against a looming pension system overhaul. The metro, trams and railways were affected. Some commuters were left scrambling.
It's really difficult. On Line 8, they're telling us no trains, nothing, just deal with it. Apparently, Line 14 is so full, it's a big mess. It's really hellish.
But other Parisians were taking things in their stride.
RATP wants to be heard, so on the one side, they're right. But we're blocked. That's how it is. We're doing what we can. It's important. It's for our retirement. I support them despite everything.
I took the train. Everything was fine, but there's no metro, so I need to walk for about 20 minutes. But apparently, it keeps you in shape.
These are the biggest protests of their kind in a decade, and there could be more to come, since they're all to challenge the radical reform and standardisation of the French system's complex pensions. Sophie Pedder of The Economist in Paris told Nigel Cassidy more.
It is a real test for President Macron. You know, he's come in with this promise that he made in his manifesto to reorganise French pensions. I mean, the purpose of this isn't primarily to raise the retirement age or do what other countries have done. It's really to simplify what is an absolute tangle of pension regimes in France. You have 42 different systems. And if you move job, you have to move system. And you often can't combine your rights. And nobody knows where they are. And the rules are different according to what jobs you do. You know, if you're a railway worker, you get particular advantages. So he's trying to merge this all into a single system. But inevitably, that's going to mean there are losers. And that's what's, I think, really motivating the strike, is the sense that privileges that have been enjoyed in the past won't be there.
Of course, the French have something of a reputation for going on strike, and there tends to be a lot of sympathy with unions. But do French people also understand the need for this simplification and change? Because after all, they themselves are taxpayers.
I think there is an understanding that, you know, the system can't go on as it is forever, but that's often a sort of theoretical understanding about what's good for France or what's good for the public finances. But when it comes to actually touching your own future pension, it sometimes feels a little bit different. And I think that there is, a sense that the unions have struggled to get people onto the streets and struggled to get a high participation. And they really want to make this a day, a sort of show of force, to try and show the government that they are serious and that they can put people on the streets and have successful industrial action.
Of course, until recently, there were those weekly shows of force by the so-called Gilets Jaunes, who were also bringing various claims to the government. Has that kind of changed attitudes? Has that had any effect on how people are feeling about this strike?
Well, it's really sort of quite a separate protest movement. The Gilets Jaunes was not union-led. It was people who felt that their voices were not being heard. This one is very much the union sort of getting back onto the centre stage and showing that they can still mobilise people. The great fear is that the two kind of come together.
That was Sophie Pedder of The Economist. Next to a scandal involving a top TV actress from one of America's most popular shows.
I think I can top that. Try getting thrown out of Disneyland for lewd behaviour.
What? When was this?
When Tom and I were first married, things got a little out of hand on Mr. Toad's wild ride.
You're kidding.
No, we got perp walked down Main Street, USA.
That was Felicity Huffman starring in Desperate Housewives. And until fairly recently, that was what she was best known for. But now she's been sentenced to 14 days in prison for her involvement in a college admission scandal. David Willis told me more from Washington.
Felicity Huffman admitted back in May of this year that she pleaded guilty to a single count of conspiracy and fraud. She admitted paying $15,000 to have her daughter's exam grades altered in order to help that daughter, Sophia, get into an elite university. With the help of a man called Rick Singer, the college admissions consultant, who is at the centre of this scheme. And a total of 51 people have been charged in connection with the scandal. Felicity Huffman was the first to be sentenced. Her sentence, of course, 14 days, as you mentioned, in prison, beginning on the 25th of October.
And she's not the only Hollywood star that's become embroiled in this, is she?
She's not. Others like the TV soap opera and sitcom star Lori Loughlin have pleaded not guilty. Lori Loughlin stands accused of paying $500,000 in bribes to get her daughter into the University of Southern California as a crew recruit, despite having never actually participated in the sport of sailing. The feeling is, there's a lot of speculation now, of course, on social media, that if found guilty, Laurie Loughlin could be facing a longer sentence, perhaps a considerably longer sentence, than 14 days in prison.
And there was a real outcry about this scandal, wasn't there, David? A lot of people very angry about accusations of rich people manipulating the system for their children.
Well, it's interesting. The judge in this case, Indira Talwani, said the case had sparked outrage, as she put it. The US college system is already distorted by money and privilege, she pointed out. And people like Felicity Huffman are seen as using their wealth and influence to gain even more advantage. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It's been a very controversial case here in the United States.
David Willis. Taiwan has chosen the same-sex romantic comedy Dear Ex as its submission for the upcoming Oscar race for Best International Feature Film. But this might cause a headache for China. Tensions are already high between Taiwan and mainland China, which it considers a province. And in recent months, China has criticised companies for not calling Taiwan Chinese Taiwan. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, explains what the film's about.
Well, this film, Dear Ex, is a Taiwanese film, and it's about a widow who discovers that her husband has left all his money not to her, but to a gay lover.
And what is it about this film that is going to possibly upset China so much?
Well, because it touches a very controversial topic of homosexuality, which China still finds somewhat taboo. And it's had a very contentious relationship with Taiwan in recent months, because Taiwan has, well, become the first region in all of Asia to allow for same-sex marriage. And it's also played into the politics. And it's become one of the kind of symbols of Taiwan, of openness and democracy. So for a film that touches on some very topical issues, I mean, this film came out in November 2018, but it started a lot of campaigning in Taiwan for more LGBT rights in the region. And yeah, these haven't caught up in China whatsoever. So this film touches on some quite sensitive topics. But it is important to note that Taiwan submits different films from mainland China for the Oscars. So China will submit a film. It hasn't yet.
So will this film be shown in China? And if it is, will they be deleting scenes? Because I know we talked about Bohemian Rhapsody, how that was severely edited when it was shown in China.
And there have been other controversies as well. There was, back when Eurovision was on, China censored the rainbow flags that were seen in the audience. There were big blurs over them. So it has had some sensitivities towards homosexual content.
So if this wins the Oscar, people aren't going to be happy.
Well, another interesting thing is whether or not people will actually see this, because when Taiwan won the Oscars last, which was the year 2000 with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Taiwan was referred to as Taiwan. They said the award goes to Taiwan. And in recent years, China has been increasingly ramping up a lot of rhetoric to overseas companies and countries that if they mention Taiwan, they have to say Chinese Taiwan. So if the Oscars doesn't do this, they're not going to show it in China whatsoever. Also, it would be a bit embarrassing, and China doesn't really want to give a lot of focus to Taiwan in a controversial film like this at the moment, because it's the run-up to the Taiwan election in January 2020. So they want to really put the emphasis on now more than ever that Taiwan, whoever comes into power, has to recognise that Taiwan is part of China.
That was Kerry Allen. The rapper in Idlib creating art amid the chaos.
So go ahead, stifles people, press as best you can. Regimes feeding on the bleeding of the common man.
Now, following on from Thursday's late edition of the podcast, we return to the issue dividing the United States, the treatment of migrants. The US government is urging countries in Central America to stop migrants crossing their countries as they try to reach the US. The BBC's Catherine B. Ruhanga has been following a group of Cameroonian migrants making that journey. In her first report, she left the group as they started their trek through the dangerous Darien Gap jungle between Colombia Colombia and Panama. In this second report, she tries to find them on the other side.
Most Africans travelling through Latin America to get to the United States will probably come to this small village near the town of La Penita in Panama. The authorities have set up a makeshift camp here for migrants, which plays host to around 1,000 people at any given time.
This camp is divided into different sections. So in front of me is a green metallic warehouse where you have a lot of Cameroonians and Congolese living. Opposite it is what looks like a wooden house, a wooden shack. And in there you find a lot of Pakistanis. Further down are a group of tents. And in there you have Angolans, Haitians. To the side are Cubans as well.
We arrived hoping to meet a group of Cameroonians we left in Colombia 6 days earlier. We haven't been able to contact them since then. And the stories we hear from those who have made it through have us worried.
In the forest, we encountered many problems. Firstly, it is difficult to get to and off the path.
Julva from the Democratic Republic of Congo has just arrived. His hands and feet are bruised. He tells me some people died along the way.
There were people who were walking. They didn't know how to climb the mountains. They did not have enough strength. So someone fell and banged their head on the rocks and died. So there are a lot of corpses.
We meet Rose, also from the Congo, and her six-month-old grandson. Rose made the crossing with her grandson, her two daughters, and her husband. She says she barely made it out of the Darien Gap after nearly drowning twice in the deep rivers they had to cross.
I saw myself dying. I was in despair. I was only waiting for God to save me. Thank God, my husband came to save me and grabbed me and brought me to the riverbank. And another girl caught my hair and helped my husband pull me out of the water. I will never tell anyone to follow this path, never.
Drug cartels and armed bandits also roam the jungle. They rob and kill migrants who are easy prey. And in some cases, girls and women are raped. Rita is a Cameroonian woman who has travelled separately from the group of her compatriots I have been following.
We saw a little girl, she's 14, is it 13? She was walking with a little brother with another group, then her parents were behind. So the group took the little brother ahead and she slowly walked, waiting for the parents to meet her. One of the Panama guys there at the jungle met her and raped her.
It's been almost a week since we set off with that group back in Colombia. They thought they would be here by now, but we haven't seen them at the camp, and we haven't been able to reach them on their phones either, so we're not quite sure where they are right now.
Then a few days later, I receive a voice message from Paul, the leader of the Cameroonian group, saying they have all made it through. They may have made it through the Darien Gap, but they still have to cross five countries and travel several thousand kilometres before making it to the US border.
Next, as bloody conflict continues to rage in Syria's last rebel-held province of Idlib, you wouldn't expect to find much musical creativity there now. Yet, amid the bombing and the frightening dictates of armed Islamist extremists, a young man has been busy composing rap songs. 20-year-old Amir, who studies graphic design by day, spends his nights rapping against all those he blames for the death and destruction around him. President Assad, his Russian and Iranian allies, gun-toting militants and corrupt officials. Our correspondent Mike Thompson has been talking to Amir and has this report.
Sidestepping piles of debris, a bearded, black-clad figure ambles past bullet-holed walls, defiantly rapping.
This is the playground of the Russian leader, where you have to choose between regime and Al-Qaeda. Pick their side and you'll be safe from the rockets. Now see if all that talk at Sochi was able to stop it.
ثانيا حبيت كتابي كثير
I have a passion for writing and rap, especially because I see it as a political tool that allows me to freely take a stand against anything and to creatively accompany my words with the rhythms and beats that I want.
Though Amir's personal life certainly hasn't been much to sing about. The intensive bombing forced his family to flee their home, and his brother was killed trying to cross into Turkey, which borders Idlib province. Amir managed to make it, but soon felt compelled to go back.
I returned because after the death of my brother, I became the eldest member of my family.
What do your family think of you rapping while bombs are falling?
They are supportive. It is my father who supported me materially in order to be able to buy the necessary equipment. So go ahead, stifle speed, repress as best you can. Regime's feeding on the bleeding of the common man. One day Russia's ushering peace delegation. Next, another camp is bombed to annihilation.
President Assad and his Russian allies aren't Amir's only targets. Extremist Islamist militia groups like HTS or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which controls most of rebel-held Idlib, get a tongue-lashing too.
HTS false witnesses accuse you of theft, telling lies of what you took when you've got nothing left. While they're the ones in mansions with fancy cars and guns, manipulating markets to crush the working ones.
That was the rapper Amir there performing for Mike Thompson. And now to Kenya and a row over dreadlocks and Rastafarianism. The High Court in Kenya has ruled that Rastafarianism is a religion and should be treated as equal to others. The ruling was made after a high school stopped a young girl from joining because of her dreadlocks. Rhoda Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The ruling delivered by Judge Chacha Mwita found that the school's decision not to allow a student to continue with her studies was unconstitutional, adding that it's a manifestation of her religion. The case was filed by the girl's parents, who argued that the law signify her faith and would not shave them. They also say that the school's action amounted to discrimination, despite the Kenyan constitution stating that every person has the right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief and opinion. There are no standard constitutional laws regulating dress codes in Kenyan schools. However, the country's Basic Education Act allows learning institutions to formulate rules that safeguard learning. The legal provision for formulating these rules restricts school administrations from clamping down on individual rights of exercising religion, among other privileges.
That was Rhoda Odhiambo. In a book published last year, the British singer Lily Allen wrote that she'd been sexually assaulted by a co-worker at the height of her fame. Now she's told the BBC podcast, The Next Episode, that her record label has taken no action against the man. The BBC understands her alleged attacker still works in the music industry. The podcast's host, Makita Oliver, has been talking to Lily Allen about her experience.
Victims of this sort of abuse are encouraged not to talk about it. I think I'm pretty realistic about what the music industry is, and it's a really dark place. It's about protecting big, powerful men in positions of influence.
Lily Allen says a record industry executive assaulted her in a hotel room in the Caribbean in 2016.
I buried it within myself. I mean, actually, that's not entirely true, because the working relationship between myself and this person did eventually disintegrate. And I grew to really, really dislike him as a person and as an idea. I made a decision that I didn't want to go to the police. I didn't want to, you know, make a fuss.
Have you had any engagement from your record label since you wrote about the assault that happened to you in the book?
Yes, I went out for dinner with, you know, one of the label bosses, and he said to me that he had no idea about this incident until he read about it in the book.
Did he say, now that we know, boy, are we going to do something about it?
No.
Who is that?
That's the boss of the whole label.
The boss of the entire label?
Yeah. Nobody wants to have the conversation. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because then they have to talk about their culpability and their knowledge of things knowing. And if their job isn't to protect an artist within that, then what are they doing in that company? What are they doing there?
The BBC understands that acts associated with her attacker continue to work with Warner. A spokesperson from Warner Music said Lily Allen's reports of sexual abuse are appalling. And they said, "We take accusations of sexual misconduct extremely seriously and investigate claims that are raised with us. We're very focused on enforcing our code of conduct and providing a safe and professional environment at all times."
People are always questioning what the victim's intentions are, or, you know, what it is that their sort of end game is. And to me, it's just like, I think the victims just want validation. They just want someone to go, yeah, that happened. That was wrong. You're a person. Somebody crossed the line with you.
Yeah, honestly,
it's it's not that the victim's like, yes, I've been sexually assaulted, I can make loads of money. It's like, no, that's not what anyone wants. If someone just wants someone to hold their hand and go, that's really awful. I'm really sorry that you had to go through that experience.
The singer-songwriter has been signed to Warner since 2013 and is currently working on her last album for the label.
I'm really excited about doing things in a more independent way and not having to worry about these, you know, dark forces and big powerful men.
For the full interview with Lily Allen, search for the next episode on BBC Sounds.
Makita Oliver talking to Lily Allen. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.